This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm interviewing Martin Lemelman, who's the author and creator of a book called 2 Cents Plain, My Brooklyn Boyhood. How are you, Martin?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good to talk to you. Well, for I assume, you know, always assume that people who are listening will not be familiar with the books that I'm talking about. And this one, people probably would need to know, is I guess what you would call, and I think your publisher calls, an illustrated memoir. And that is, I think, based in the fact that you're by profession an illustrator.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you could talk a little bit about kind of your work as an artist and how this book came into being.
Well, I think when I started, I went to Brooklyn College and I was a painting major. And when I graduated, they said, well, you can drive a taxi in the daytime and maybe paint at night. And that wasn't really an option for me because growing up in New York City, in Brooklyn, I didn't know how to drive, first of all. And I wanted to try to make a living out of my art. And so through a long series of different events, I decided to work in illustration. And I got my first job creating paintings. I did things for Esquire magazine and National Lampoon and things like that, magazines like that. And as I went on, I started teaching illustration. And then it almost seems it's kind of interesting because every 7 to 10 years, my style would change and my focus would change. And just about 6 years ago or 7 years ago, I did my first graphic memoir, which was about my mother's life in living her life before the World War II in Poland and surviving the Holocaust. And this is almost like a new phase in my creating art.
And so, the first book, I guess I should mention, it's called Mendel's Daughters.
Yeah.
Mendel's Daughter, singular.
Yeah.
And that is about, that's the story of your mother.
Right.
And then this book is really, it's your childhood growing up in Brooklyn. And I think you were born 1949, is that right?
1950.
And so, you know, your parents, and you obviously talk about this through the book, and, you know, there are many complex things about their lives, both prior to World War II, during World War II, and then when they came to America. But obviously that was a very big part of your growing up. And this book becomes it's your memoir, but it's still so much about your parents. You know.
Well, I think that when I started writing it, and I always start doing anything, you know, doing the first graphic now, memoir, and this one, I write it. And as I was writing it, it didn't seem enough to just tell about how I grew up, because it really didn't give the whole view of what formed me and what formed my my childhood. And so it almost became necessary to go back a little bit and talk about, you know, the attitudes and the way my parents viewed the world. And so I had to take another trip to the streets of Poland to really inform what happened to me in Brooklyn.
Right, and of course what happened to them during World War II.
Right,
I mean, especially your mother, I think, had a very difficult time. Your father ended up being in the Russian army. That was a really interesting story too.
Right.
You know, that's sort of part of his being, this idea that he had that, you know, on some level, which Russia was better, which was a view pretty unpopular, I would think, in the 1950s. He probably didn't say that to very many people.
Well, he actually said it to his, like, comrades. People, you know, would come into the store and it was a place where people would come and get their egg creams and 2 cents plain seltzer and newspapers, and then they just would talk about politics and everything. And my father had this bent towards Russia, and I think to me one of the reasons, and it came not so much from when I was a child, but thinking about why my father liked Russia, it wasn't so much the communism, but he admired Stalin. Now that sounds really off the wall. Why would anybody admire Stalin? And there's a story in the book about how he wrote a letter to Stalin after he was, taken out of prison, and that's another story. But he wrote to Stalin asking to be let out of the army and go back to see if anybody in his town and his family survived. And my father always swore that Stalin answered him back, and he let him go, which sounds really, it's very unbelievable to me that, they weren't letting anybody out of the army, out of the Russian army then. But he says they let him out. And he went to see what there was left of his hometown, and there was very little left of his hometown. So I think he admired Stalin more than, the communist system.
Yeah, no, and I thought, that's sort of part of your style in this book, is that you really, in some ways pulled no punches. It's warts and all, the good and the bad about your family and some of the suffering and struggling that they went through themselves and then kind of passed on to you. And similarly, I thought that you did that in terms of describing the neighborhood and the changes that occurred while you were there. I thought it was very evocative without being sentimental, and you were also able to kind of talk about social issues in a pretty honest way, which I think was pretty good.
Yeah, I think that, in this, it was for me doing that. I when I did this book, and it was like, the only reason I would do a book like this is to try to see all of the aspects of life. And I didn't want it to just be, this nostalgic book. And I think there is nostalgia in the book with the comic books and the old neighborhood and the kind of interesting characters. But I think it wasn't only that, and I didn't want it only to be that.
Right, well, that's sort of trite, and that I think, what you've managed, I think you've avoided the trite and sentimental pretty well, and that, it's obviously, as you say, there are things that one must always feel nostalgic for, these kind of artifacts of the past,
mm-hmm.
but, the past is not always better than the present, or it's people create these fantasies of the past as somehow wonderful. The 1950s were great and things are terrible today. That's a kind of motif that people create for themselves. And that I think that narrative is one you've resisted. There's a lot of stuff in your story that is kind of painful to read about. I thought your style was great because, and I felt this very strongly when I picked up the book, I just felt brought in immediately. And it may be a function of your drawing style. It may be, maybe it's the little, Yiddish sayings on the bottom of chapter openers or something. You did avoid that kind of path toward over sentimentalizing
right.
the past.
Well, yeah, I appreciate that. The thing I think it's kind of funny when you say that. It's when I finished the book, and I looked at it, I thought my book is like my father's candy store counter. Like when my father first opened his store, the counter was empty. You can sit there and have an ice cream soda or a frap or whatever. But as the years go by, he started putting stuff on it, the candies and the toys kept piling up. And then he started buying stuff which was kind of really unusual, and you'd find light bulbs or you'd find lady stockings or just weird kind of things. And so it kept piling up. And then I looked at the book and I said, you know what, that's kind of like my book, where there's a lot of, I mean, there's a narrative and a straightforward narrative to the whole thing, but through the whole book there's, I think, this richness of trying to give the whole flavor of it, not just saying it's one thing, but it's many different things, and it's this, and as when you turn the page, you're not really kind of sure what's going to happen on the next page. It could be a drawing, it could be a bunch of drawings, it could be a document, it could be a Yiddish saying with a collage photograph. So there's a lot of stuff going on, and so I felt that, and with that it is a nostalgia, but it's also the kind of bitterness and the hardship of that time as well. So it's kind of a lot of different things.
Oh yeah, no, I think that's true, and you kind of get a feeling, and I think the graphic novel or the graphic memoir component of it helps add to the richness. You know, I think with straight written text, obviously the reader fills in with his or her own imagination what the writer is saying,
mm-hmm.
and you paint a picture in your mind, in your own mind, of a place and time. And with the graphical element, then that changes. That as we engage with the text, there's now the additional information that we get, which is your visual imagery of what that place and time was like. And I think that, there's sort of an interesting difference there between traditional writing and illustrated writing for adults, not just for children.
Right.
But I think that there is a lot of richness there. And as you say, some surprises, you know, some things that, you know, weren't so good. And I loved actually the whole thing about your father and the countertop. I'd been reading something about, you know, merchandising in stores,
mm-hmm.
and I've been reading that, and I was thinking about your father as kind of the anti-merchandiser. You know, this is a guy who wasn't thinking at all about merchandising, which usually is done by having fewer things so you can let people concentrate on what they're seeing.
Right.
His was a kind of almost unnatural marketing.
Oh yeah. Well, it was a kind of like surreal almost when you go into the store, because the other element of that is you couldn't really. He was very impatient with his customers. So if you'd go in, you'd kind of have to make your choices really fairly quickly, because he'd throw you out of the store if you did.
Right, you're thinking too hard. You got to buy some. Well, but that's a very old-fashioned push cart type of thinking about the customer.
Yeah.
That, you know, I've only got a certain amount of time in the day. You're only going to give me a nickel anyway, so make up your mind. I don't have time for you to be thinking about stuff.
Yeah. So that was my mother and my father in the store. It was like, and I always wondered when I was a kid, why would you want to go to my store? You know, it was like, I'd go to some other store where they were nicer. But they people kept coming back to the store. Kids kept coming back to the store, and because they'd always get a good deal, and with a good deal, maybe they'll have a curse or two. But they'd be cursed out. But it was okay, you know, because they get a nickel ice cream or a toy or whatever it was, and so that was okay with them. And
so do you keep? I mean, you obviously, you know, it's sort of interesting because that period of time when you were there, it's boundaried on one side. You know, I don't know who lived in those neighborhoods before, before you got there. You know,
right.
Maybe the post-war Jewish immigration into that neighborhood was, you know, relatively a new thing, but it didn't last very long. And by, you know, sometime in the late 50s, early 60s, the neighborhoods changed. The population became more Hispanic and more Black.
Right.
And so you're really talking about a period of your life which was kind of coincidental to a cultural era's ending. And do you keep up with people that you knew from that neighborhood? Do you know anybody that you grew up with?
I know a couple of people. I know where they are, and I've spoken to them over the years, but not recently. The thing with the neighborhood is it's almost like it disappeared after, the, you know, the 50s, where there were mostly, there were a lot of different people. There were Italian people and Irishmen, Irish people, and there were some Afro-Americans and Puerto Ricans. But mostly it was Jews who had survived the war, the Holocaust. And there were, and, but then my father and some other shopkeepers, but not many, decided to stay. But a lot of them just kind of like my friends would kind of go off and, you know, go to different neighborhoods, Canarsie, the Bronx, wherever, and I kind of stayed within that neighborhood. My father was almost kind of, I think he, I don't know the disease, but he was afraid to leave the store, in a way, and so he kind of held on to this as long as possible, you know, and where everybody else was kind of going off and losing touch with us, so we were there in the neighborhood. And one of the other things, I think, as I was writing this book, and just kind of brings me to what you were saying, is that I couldn't do this book without kind of pulling in some of historical references. You know, when my mother and father were in the DP camp about Patton or Eisenhower and their relationship to the Jews in the camp, or Kennedy or Eisenhower during their campaign, Malcolm X and the attitude of how the Afro-American community changed their feelings for the, you know, their sense of what Jews were, you know, and they thought they were exploiters, and so that kind of thing. So it almost forced me to kind of do other research to kind of bring these things in to make, again, this kind of fuller picture of why things were happening to me in specific, but in general, what was happening to our society. You know, and that I didn't intend to do at the beginning, but as I was going and doing the writing and doing the illustration, I was almost forced to put things into context.
Well, I think that's exactly right. They give you context, and they were, you know, I know when we're kids, you know, growing up, the happenings of the world at large are less real to us than they are when we're grown-ups. And you know, you're writing about and illustrating a period of your life when you were relatively young. So, you know, you may, as you said, you have to kind of go out and reconstruct what the greater context was that you lived in or within which you lived when you were young. But those events and those feelings were kind of societal feelings and cultural activities were surrounding what was happening to you as an individual.
Yeah, I mean, even, you know, people, I think, know of the Knapp Commission from, I think, Serpico, the movie, and I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, so in a way, throughout my childhood, the police would come in and take whatever they wanted, whether it was cigarettes or newspapers or sodas, and just leave. And as a kid, I thought that's what you were supposed to, they were allowed to do that, you know, and my sense of my parents believed that they had no other choice. It's funny how as a kid you see different things and make a connection to how your life is changing through kind of very simple things. For instance, in the store, we used to sell a lot of Farvitz and Morgenjournal, which were the Yiddish papers, and then it turned into being La Prensa, El Diario, and Amsterdam News, which were the Afro-American and Spanish papers. My father started stocking pork rinds. You know, this was something that in the 50s would have been inconceivable. He couldn't really move that kind of stuff. But in the 60s, that became a big product for him. So that was one thing. And the other thing is that my parents were starting to be robbed in the store. And so as a kid, you're kind of, you know, devastated. The people have come to the store, taken money. And at the time, the police would come and really do nothing about it. And I had a feeling about that. The only thing I saw about the police there was that they were able to come into the store at other times and just take stuff from us. And so my belief when I was a little kid was that the police were allowed by law to go in and take newspapers and candy and cigarettes and all that kind of stuff. And so writing this book, putting it in more of a historical context, I try to bring in a sense of really looking at this through a historical context. So the Knapp Commission that was saw through to the police corruption, and they were called, the police at that time were called grass eaters when they would take these little, you know, this stuff from the people. So I think I wanted to put my sense of being a child and what happened at that time, and also to kind of bring it to a broader historical perspective.
Right, and I think you actually did that very well because you communicate pretty powerfully the feelings that you had, the fear. Suddenly you're growing up, you know, you're comfortable and you're at home, and then you start to be afraid. And your parents, of course, for them, there was this, you know, terrible thing that happens where they come to America to escape anti-Semitism and to get away from Europe, where they were, you know, they have painful memories of being despised for simply being Jewish, and then all of a sudden it begins to happen again. Or that the police, you know, who are not their protectors, you know, that these evoke for your parents, I thought, some fairly, you know, painful, obviously painful memories.
Yeah, I think that was even the sharpest kind of hit for them. I mean, they really couldn't believe that they came to America with the understanding that this would be a better life for them and their children. And what was happening is their world was turning upside down. It was a reprise of what was happening in Europe, what happened in Europe to them. And so that was just awful to kind of have to relive that again.
Right, and so then it changed their orientation to the place and, of course, made them unhappy. And eventually they had to close the store. When did the store actually finally close?
Well, it closed about a week, I believe, after Martin Luther King got assassinated, and there were riots. And there's a whole story about how my father actually saved my mother from having a knife around her neck, and so that was the end. My mother was ready to finish the store, you know, finish with the store earlier than that. She was getting fed up with getting robbed and all that. But my father held on tenaciously. He wanted to keep this store. It was his store. He built it. He felt it didn't matter who his customers were. He said all he cared was, he didn't care the color of the customer. He only cared that the color of the money was green.
Right.
And so that was his sense of it. But then it was the last straw with somebody holding a knife to my mother, and he couldn't take it anymore.
So, and just what did they end up doing after the store closed? I know.
Well, they moved a couple of times. Finally, they moved to Far Rockaway. My father had a candy store during the summer seasons in in Long Beach, New York, and they made a living until he retired, I guess.
Well, you obviously capture this period, and you know, I just thought it was brilliant. And I guess for people who may be less aware of, you know, some of the accoutrement of the candy store, the soda fountain kind of places that existed at that time in New York, you know, and I remember growing up, you know, when you go into the city, that was the only place you could get a 2 cents plain,
yeah.
Which is basically seltzer water.
Yeah, seltzer, right.
You know, it's kind of the cheapest thing you could buy.
Right, right.
But did you also learn how to make an egg cream?
Oh, I learned. I mean, I basically did everything in the store. My first job was standing in front of the, we had the papers outside, and I would collect money from people who were in a hurry and just wanted to buy a newspaper. So I learned my math from the nickels and dimes that people would give me and making change. So from that, I do egg creams and ice creams as well. I'd experiment with egg creams, and I tried lemon syrup and cherry syrup and strawberry syrup. Some were really disgusting, they would curdle, and it was like magic. The best ones really are the chocolate and vanilla egg cream, and I do give a recipe in the book, so that's
right. I agree. I think that the fruit flavors just don't work.
No. I thought about it. I thought it would be interesting. I guess I should have been a scientist.
I do, although some people like cherry, I guess.
Yeah.
Maybe cherry works. I don't know. Well, so, having done now two graphic memoirs for adults, and I know you've done a lot of children's books.
Right.
What's next? What do you have planned for?
Well, I'd like to continue. I want to do a trilogy, and so the last book I believe in the trilogy is how I became an artist, and it's kind of interesting. I think of the gallery world and the illustration world, and going to school, a nice little Jewish yeshiva boy, becoming an artist and drawing naked models. So I think that's the kind of, I hope to have it, I hope to work on that.
Right, so that's sort of your James Joyce period.
I guess.
So, and do you still do children's books?
I haven't done them for a while. It's kind of funny you asking me that, because just recently, a former client called up and wanted to reuse some images that I had done for a children's workbook, and I gave them permission to use those. And they said, "Well, you want to do some others?" And I just finished about eight illustrations for this workbook, just for fun, I think. But I think my heart is in doing the graphic memoirs. I love the complexity of it. And it's almost like doing a symphony. I think the children's books are more like sweet 3-minute songs in a way for me. So I love the idea of doing something for like 3 years.
Yeah, no, I think I can see how for someone who has that, you've got the talent and the ambition. It is like writing a symphony, and except you don't need the orchestra. You can do it all yourself.
Right. And also, I'm not sure that I can do it, actually. So I think that's also, I've been doing illustration for so many years, and what's wonderful about being an art, I think, in a lot of different types of art, I guess, is that you're never sure. You're always curious about how the thing is going to look, and so I'm never like totally confident in something, and I think that's a good thing because it becomes new.
Right. No, I think that's right. I think for you, it gives you the challenge that you need to rise to a new occasion.
Right. Well, it's interesting because when I decided, I think when I was, when I decided to become an artist, one of the reasons, it was kind of a weird reason, is that I wanted to have a job that I didn't have to retire from. And I don't know why my mind was going there when I was like whenever 15 or whatever it was. And so actually, you don't retire from being an artist.
That's right. No, and the challenges, and as you said earlier, I think, that if you can reinvent yourself periodically, you can become a new artist, almost every 7 or 10 years.
Yeah.
The reinvention is great.
Yeah, and I think, one of the things about the graphic memoirs is, like, the first one, Mendel's Daughter, is, you look at the style of that one as opposed to the second one, Two Cents Plain, and they're on the surface they're the same, but there are profound differences between the two in terms of the structure and the pacing of the book, and the almost it's more of a sense of they're more almost. I did twice as many drawings in Two Cents Plain as opposed to Mendel's Daughter. I wanted there was a different sense to what I wanted to say in both of the books.
Well, it may also be that as you do these, your sense of them becomes deeper.
I think so. I think so. It becomes. It's not only that. I mean, when I went to do Mendel's Daughter, I wanted to be a simple story, just my mother's story, and my mantra was keep it simple, stupid, K-I-S-S.
Mm-hmm.
And so the drawings I wanted to keep very simple and sparse. In the second book, with the 50s and 60s and the richness of what was happening and the store and my parents' journey, it becomes much, and the different memories, because in the first book it's only my mother's memory, and here it's my memory and my brother's memory and my parents' memory, and they all look at things differently. And so that adds to, it becomes a different kind of visual as well, besides being a different kind of narrative.
Oh, it's really interesting. Well, you know, I hope that for people who are hearing this, because they can't see the work themselves, that they'll be able to get a sense of how interesting it is, and you know, take a look online and visit their favorite bookseller and see the book. I think they'll like it very much.
Yeah, I also have there's a website, just twocentsplain.com. And there are some drawings and information about the book and sample art. So if people want to take a look as well.
Well, thanks so much, Martin. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host. I've been talking to Martin Lemelman, who's the author and artist, creator of Two Cents Plain, My Brooklyn Boyhood. Thanks so much, Martin.
Thanks, David. Bye.